And if he's honest, and if he's got courage, he'll work out this problem. The first problem will result in disaster. He will wait for God, and God probably won't do a damn thing. But as time progresses, he will learn what to pray for and what not to pray for.
This is Dr. Lawson.
Oh, pleasure.
How are you? I introduced you to all of them. I will later. We don't want to interrupt them.
There's the one who's trying to do it. Call what Jesus did.
Sure.
What did he tell you? What did he
do? Yeah, he checked when they started out to go preaching. He checked the treasure. And the treasury was empty. Well, boys, he says, we'll go fishing instead. First we'll finance ourselves, then we'll go preach. I like that.
Let's go catch some fish.
Sell the fish.
Sell the fish.
Then we'll go preach.
Again, I find this concept of thing, meaning, and value to be of tremendous worth. How do you approach the problem? Question.
I was taking that to the example that you gave of a man who wanted to take his wife to dinner and to the groom.
Yeah.
And suddenly, the problem was...
It works for Charlie. It doesn't work for me.
Do you think it's a lack of faith because it doesn't work?
I can't tell you. I only have my own yardsticks. If I need money, I work for it. Now, Charlie, this worked for Charlie. When he was broke, somebody always showed up wanting to get married. And that was $20, or whatever he needed. And he insisted this worked. Now, I don't criticize that. I merely say this does not work for me. But then I'm not a minister. Charlie had to...
Maybe you're lying.
I have no criticism of Charlie's philosophy. But then, let's face it, the probabilities were better in his profession than in mine.
It would certainly be something to work for.
Sure.
Then if this suddenly began to happen to you,
I don't...
Perhaps, maybe then, what would your reaction be? Would you be fearful?
No, I wouldn't be fearful. I won at roulette in Monte Carlo once, playing a simple system, which is beside the point. I just didn't want to make all those decisions. You get ulcers making that many decisions in one day, so I followed the system. I was lucky. I won. Now, I don't think Providence had anything to do with that. This was my lucky day. If I'm hot enough playing poker, I can fill an inside straight, but normally, it's not a good hand to draw to, if you know what I mean. I dissociate material prosperity from spiritual status rather completely in my thinking. Rodin, whose Greek philosophy is, you'll love that paper in part four, Rodin of Alexandria. Rodin put it this way. He said, if man wants to prosper, he should camp alongside the streams where wealth flows. Failing this, he can devote a life of service to his fellow man without much in the way of material reward. Now, I've been prosperous, not because of this blue book or anything of the kind. I camp alongside the streams where wealth flows. I've made a lot more money than my father, because they paid Papa after taxes. They pay my bills before taxes. I work for corporations. He works for people who are notoriously late in paying a doctor. Are you a medical man?
No, sir, not medical.
Well, you know the problem.
Right.
I think if you're dealing with things, I think it's a lot safer to use reason. If you're in the domain of values, I don't think reason is too effective. It's the domain of faith. If two men jump from my office window, and one is a sinner who curses his bad luck, or let's say they're pushed. He blasphemes all the way down to the pavement. The other guy is a saint who appeals to God to suspend the law of gravitation, which is an effort to practice magic. I'm sure they're going to hit the pavement with identical foot pounds of impact. From then on, I think they go in different directions. But falling objects are subject to the laws which govern things. And in this domain, gravity doesn't recognize good or evil. It just deals with things. Now what happens to their surviving souls, that's a horse of a different color. Now you're in a different domain. And there are laws which govern values, and they're quite different. One of the problems of a Christian Scientist is that they recognize only one form of energy. And in terms of this blue book, it would be an emulsification of about four parts mind and one part spirit. That's the only reality there is. Hence, there is only one set of laws. This book teaches me there are three kinds of energy: material, mindal, and spiritual. And I mustn't confuse the laws of spirit with the laws of matter. If I have a sick child, I'm going to get a pediatrician. And I cannot, without committing blasphemy, ask God to suspend natural law to clear up the infection or the virus in that child. That's, at my state of enlightenment, that's blasphemous. It's an effort to practice magic. I have no criticism of someone else who prays that way. They could pray very sincerely, I think. I can't. All I can pray for is to be thankful that regardless of whether that child lives or dies, that child cannot be seriously hurt. I can be hurt as a parent, but that child can't be seriously hurt. Either I will raise that child or God will raise her. I can be thankful that God has so constituted the universe that a child gets a break, whether they get it here or over there. Psychosomatic reactions and somatopsychic reactions. And this complicates the hell out of a simple three-way division. Let's imagine that we are a primitive tribe.
On several occasions, had no money to even buy a bottle of milk for the baby.
Hello, doctor.
And about that time, someone who hadn't even heard from him in many months decided to send him a check. And they got it just at the time they hadn't got 1 cent.
Mm-hmm.
All food.
Are we in business?
In business.
Transaction. One of our until recently a warrior in good standing, Ugwala by name, has violated one of the major tribal taboos, a crime sin. Unfortunately, there is no forgiveness for this. It's too bad. Ugwala must die. And the witch doctor is going through the death incantation. And Ugwala sits at the end of the table there, some distance from the rest of us. We don't want to be contaminated. And when he comes to the apex of his incantation and puts the purple powder on the fire and it flares, Ugwala, as well as we, Ugwala knows he's going to die. And this major emotion of fear triggers his adrenal glands and puts just enough adrenaline in his bloodstream to rupture the heart muscle. And there we are watching him, and no one touches him, and he falls over, and he's just as dead as a mackerel. And if that isn't convincing, I want to know what kind of evidence you want. We know that the spirits killed Ugwala, and we now again have occasion to venerate the witch doctor. Here is where you get into a gray area where you can be trapped with all sorts of borderline phenomena, because prayer is a psychological thing as well as a spiritual thing, and we do have psychosomatic repercussions. I think that prayer can have an influence over life or death if the scales are closely in balance. But if they're lopsided, I don't think all the praying in the world can keep a person from dying. But I think it can tip something that is in pretty close balance, because the mind affects the body, and the body affects the mind within limits.
Unafraid of the universe.
have implicit trust in the boss. He's my father. He knows what's good and right and helpful for me. I can't tell you how much trust I put in this. It's total. But I carry life insurance because I don't think my father particularly cares whether I live this day out or tarry here for another generation. And I have other relationships besides those which I sustain to my Father in heaven. Temporal relationships. And here I do not have faith. I'm going to get on a plane to fly to Dallas tomorrow night. We may not make it. That's the way I want to go because I have travel insurance. And my widow will be much better fixed if it happens in an airplane. And besides, it's quick that way. My partner had faith. It did nothing for cancer of the liver. We buried him. But he died with grace and courage. It's a different thing. You see, to me, if you take, let me tell you a story. Years ago, an awfully nice sparring partner of mine with Standard Oil stuck his head in my office and his face was as white as a sheet and he said, "Will, will you present my recommendations on Stanlin topside?" And I said, "Will you do your own work?" He said, "Look, I get a pain in my belly. I'm sick." And I looked at his face and he was. He went home and he took a sizable cathartic and he blew his appendix to kingdom come, and it was before penicillin. Red was not an immoral guy, he was amoral. At his funeral there were 7 girls showed up, and we had enough men detailed so that each girl left thinking she was his only sweetheart. And this took a good deal of staff work. But the gal he was currently living with was a very sweet girl. And a very devout Catholic. And when I heard the diagnosis of peritonitis, I was simply detailed to take care of Red's family and Red and do what was necessary. She talked to me. And I told her, I said, it's not good. Because peritonitis, less than 1% chance. This kid went down and got a St. Christopher's medal and had it blessed. And she pinned it on a pillow. And she grinned at me and she said, "I hope you're okay now." I damn near died because I knew he was going to die. And she shouldn't subject her faith to those stupid tests any more than one would box a buzzsaw barehanded. Now there's the tragedy of the failure to recognize the different laws covering different circumstances. That's right. And I held that poor kid on my lap while she cried her full heart out when he died. The thing that confuses is the psychosomatic, somatopsychic overlap, because apparently you can cross these borders. And that's why I think it takes, that's why to achieve a real childlike simplicity of faith demands great sophistication.
Yes, and the man who needs money.
Look, I won at Monte Carlo. Now, it was very necessary for the continuation of a nice trip in Europe. But I did this without praying.
Yeah.
And I had carefully stashed my passage money in case I lost. I could get back home. I think in case of doubt, it's good to pray.
Yeah.
But I think it's very dangerous to presume on God. Here, I look at it this way. We've been equipped with the finest general purpose tools, two of them, that a good mechanic could devise. That's human hands. We're ambulatory. We get around. We've got pretty good equipment up here. And I think if the problem is solvable with human equipment, we should solve with human equipment. I don't think we should ask God for a gallon of gas until our gas tank is empty. And I think if it's really empty and there's no other source, I wouldn't hesitate to ask God for some more gas to take the hills ahead, figuratively speaking. But I think too many of us are chicken. We pray before we work. And I think we ought to test the problem. I don't think we should bother God with a lot of our trivia. These are human problems, temporal problems. They're for sharpening minds. Now stop and think of what a horrendous thing you're doing. You are signing a blank sight draft drawn on yourself. And you haven't the foggiest notion the size of the amount they're going to fill in. You signed that draft. And maybe the thing that's required to make us more useful to our fellow men is major tribulation. To make us more kind, more understanding. That's a frightening prayer, but it's the most valid prayer I think a human being can pray. You ask God to make you more useful, and you really are drawing blank sight drafts on yourself. And I think these seraphim are very ingenious on how they fill them in. So are you a little bit proud if this stands in the way and your prayer is sincere? You said, all right, eradicate from me that which keeps me from being serviceable. I don't think there's anything can stop them from doing it then. I think you'll shortly find yourself in those humiliating situations which will have a shrinking effect on pride. You know, hats that have gotten too tight will suddenly become very loose. There's a difference between childlike faith and childish faith. That's right. I will never argue with a person about his objectives of prayer, because it's better he pray stupidly than not at all. Much better. But he's leading with his chin if he prays stupidly. It's like the gal in the St. Christopher's Medal. That darn near broke my heart. She was so happy. And by chance, red rallied a little. She said, see, temperature went down a little. Pulse was better. But then he died the next morning, before dawn.
Follow that up. Did that give her a last name?
I lost track of her. I hope not. I hope it made her wiser. I'm sure her priest helped her rationalize. But you see, it's too much like, well, I think of an old pal of mine who's a Jesuit. We got to talking about prayer, and he said, well, if you're a contractor and you pray hard enough, you'll get the contract. But suppose another contractor's prayed. Well, it depends on who prays the hardest. Well, of course, they've got an out now, see. Just like the Christian Scientist has them out. You die, but this is because your faith was not pure. It's like my old grandfather was a fundamentalist, and I got him down on the south side of the quadrangle at Chicago, showed him all the trilobites in the limestone. Very interesting. And I said, well, Grandpa, it certainly indicates the world has been around for more than 6,000 years. He said, not necessarily, Junior. Well, I said, how do you figure that? Well, he said, Junior, do you believe that God made the world? Well, I said, indirectly, yes. That he made the world with the fossils in it. I said, why? He said, as a test of your faith. You're all through now, see? You've had it. You can't get inside the circle. You can't stop a Hindu who says that the world is an illusion. You say, but I think it's real. He said, see? You're deluded. But I'm chary of these oversimplifications of things. I'd much rather believe that it's a little more complex. Now, in the over on the value side, I'll go right along with the Spiritists. But on the thing side, I'm pretty hard-boiledly mechanistic. It works. And if I can work it scientifically, then I don't think I should pray for it. We've got a simpler technique. That's what I told the kids. You want an electric train? See me. You want more happiness? Discuss this with your other father. I don't know how to make you happy. Only warm, well-fed, buy you toys. You see, people are trying to oversimplify and to get one single simple answer for everything. It's what, well, we call it the eye of God in times of war. Everybody prays to the Lord God of battles in the Old Testament. And I don't think that the prayer is nearly as effective as the firepower at the point of contact.
So you get into psychological manifestation.
Sure you do. The boys that believe God's on their side are going to fight harder, no question about it. That's psychological, though, not spiritual. It's like Henry Muller, in his Uses of the Past, was quoting Cardinal Newman, where he says, the proof of the divinity of the validity of Christianity is look what it did in 400 years to the Roman Empire. And Muller chuckles and says, Allah did it much faster with Mohammedanism, and he's right. In 100 years, Mohammedanism spread much faster than Christianity. It's a lower religion. It inspired the pugnacious impulse in man. You die in battle, instantly you've got it made. You've got 24 of the sexiest babes that Allah could ever conceive of, waiting to minister to all your carnal needs, and what's more, you can drink in paradise, and no hangovers. This is a very tangible reward.
Hardly wait to do it.
Right. And you're not going to bump into your wife up there. It won't be embarrassing.
They had sharper blades.
Oh, there's a lot of reasons for that. The Monophysites split off, and the Nestorians split off. Damn foolishness of Constantinople. These people were looking for a change. It's an appealing religion. Many ways. And you can sure refute Cardinal Newman, because Allah worked a lot faster than Jehovah as far as the spread of his religion is concerned. If you want to read something cute, get Muller's. I like Muller. He's a humanist. And there's an awful lot about religion that's nonsensical. And Muller finds the chinks in the armor. His last book is The Loom of History. And when he gets to Ephesus, he starts out with the worship of the Great Mother. And he ends up with the veneration of Mary's supposed last dwelling place. Still the Great Mother. You know what I mean? And we just changed our form, but we're still venerating the Greek Mother.
I sure would like for him to have your extra books.
Yeah.
He still had them.
I think, going back to our discussion of mind, from the most I think we can work at, really, is wisdom. And this is a temporal objective. How can we discriminate better? How can we evolve? How can we keep our childlike faith childlike without becoming childish? And that which is normal to a child can be ridiculous in an adult. Child can pray for anything, completely trusting. This is not the purpose of life. Life is to teach us discrimination. Jesus even said that, where he said if he asks for a stone, you're going to give him a stone just because it looks like a loaf of bread, or a water snake because he mistakes it for a fish. He recognized the indiscriminate nature of the unsophisticated mind. We mumble in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. It's become almost a magical formula. Whereas actually what it means is, we may be asking stupidly, and here's your power of attorney to rewrite the whole petition. We're constituting him an attorney in fact, to recast this prayer into the true desires of our soul, not the passing whims of our mind. But to me, if you can win through to a sophisticated faith, and I'm using that word sophisticated in the original usage, this is not a Weisenheimer's faith. This is a hard-bitten faith. This is a faith that knows when not to pray as well as when to pray. This is a faith that doesn't ask God to perform acts of magic. My partner, who's a good Scandinavian, and you know how they can worry, he's been ill for, a year. It's hurt his work. He hasn't done good work. He hasn't known why. He didn't know whether he was slipping. I didn't either. I didn't think too much of his doctor. The doctor treated him like a guinea pig and tried all kinds of drugs on him. And when they told him the results of the exploratory operation, inoperative cancer of the liver, here's what he said to his wife and son and mother. Good. Now we can make plans. He didn't argue with the diagnosis, and he didn't ask God to change it. He knows what cancer of the liver is. He said, all right, we'll make plans. Because he had no doubt about survival. He just knew that he was through down here. He was going to pick it up there a little sooner than he planned on. This to me is sophisticated faith. This is not beating on my chest and saying, why are the arrows of the Almighty within me? What have I done to deserve this? Hell's bells, he had cancer. I go back to thing, meaning, and value. Such simple little words. And they're so helpful to me. I've proved them helpful to other people. I've given this concept to many people I've never told about this book. It straightens out our thinking. Where are we? Things. All right, let's work out an answer. Values. Mathematics is of no use over here. We can't weigh love or measure it or count it. We feel it. And then in between, let's see what we can do about trying to use logic. How do we reconcile this material world of things and this wonderful, vibrant, spiritual world of values, the existence of which at best we suspect? How can we tie the two together? explain rationally. And if you look at it this way, there's never a quarrel between science and religion. Science has nothing to say about that, and religion does not deal directly with things. Religion is concerned, as the papers say, with the scientists, not with science. This is quite a bull session we've had here. To me, this is the basic difference between childish faith and childlike faith. It's the difference between presuming on God and depending on God. It's the difference between having courage and audacity. He who presumes on God would be audacious. And this is not courage. It's recognizing the dignity of man and the limitations. That man is good up to a point. And by George, he ought to produce up to a point, pretty much on his own. And beyond that point, sure, he needs help. I don't know how to get to paradise. I need a lot of help there. I don't know how to grow. What's the help me, Hannah, when we're trying to figure out who to put in charge of a TV operation? I'm not going to pray over this. I think this is a matter of human acumen, wisdom, judgment, experience. The best measurements we can devise to determine aptitudes, willingness to work, and so on. I don't think God cares who runs that TV station. But of course the management cares, because this has a lot to do with the profitability or the non-profitability of the operation. This is a temporal problem, not a spiritual problem. And I think as we cut our teeth on temporal problems, well, if we learn to be faithful over a few things, maybe we will someday get greater responsibility. These are the little problems we're practicing on. In the larger sense, I look at this life as a kindergarten. Someday, I believe we will look back upon this life, and we will see it in a better perspective. And from that distant point of vantage in future time, we will perceive that all of our best efforts were very much like kindergartners who were trying to see how high they could stack ABC blocks before the tower toppled. But it's very important that these kindergartners learn that lesson before they move on to first grade. We're in kindergarten now. Someday we shall be first graders. Won't high school be fast? And when we've graduated from the University of Time and Space, then we'll matriculate as freshmen in the University of Eternity. And as they say, for the first time, find out what hard work really is. This to me is an exciting thing. I spent about 4,000 hours on these two books, which is a critique of this book. Let me give you the gist of how I felt about it when I got through writing it. So we should quit. Let's pray instead of eating bread.
No, I'm in favor of what Jesus would do. Go eat or fish.
Go eat. by the great adventuresomeness that seems to underlie God's purposes, as they appear to be revealed in the happenings of the history of the Master Universe, and all that goes before, and all that follows after. God pours himself out upon creation in such a prodigal manner. He gives so without measure that all may be enriched by these gifts. Such are the fruits of the infinite love which he seems to bear for all beings. God is so loving, but so unsoft. He who gives so much in love, he is also the one who challenges those whom he loves. He is the creator of problems, in the solution of which his children grow. God is so unchanging, but always the cause of change. Always is he putting the ferment of the new and the challenging into the old and the established. And as the old and the new react to each other, each challenges the other. And as each responds to the challenge of the other, both grow and rise above former limitations. God seems to want all of his children to grow, and he seems to want to be a partner with each one in that adventure of growth. He gives his spirit to live within us and to share with us the adventure of exploring his infinity in fact and his infinity of love. In the preparation of this work, the feeling has grown upon the writer that it is a story of romance and adventure, a thrilling tale of challenge and response. And the real hero of this whole story is God. This being is the most exciting personality in the wide-spreading universes. This being is the most interesting and intriguing personality in existence. This being is the author of love, and we believe the real source of the spirit of adventure. When he spoke as a man among men and to men, he said, "Follow me." And if we dare, we may.
Didn't I talk about this? This new book. Idea they have on how they can control sex.
Are you ready to hear that?
Control sex.
Oh.
You mean in the case of adults or termination in the case of the fetus? They're going to control the fetus long before they control the adult.
Well, because this was something that they could control the birth.
Uh-huh.
I just scanned it.
That's to produce a topic.
Oh, well, that's what I thought. Oh, you can control the sex.
Willie and the vices of burying people, if you want to make it easy.
The vices of burying people.
using up all this good land we could be utilizing it for agricultural purposes. Bill's guilty of it.
Yeah, but you can't get as much for it. You see, if Bill played it right, he'd keep collecting from the Department of Agriculture because he's taking his land out of
country. You probably thought of
Have
that.
Have you thought of that angle, Bill?
Probably got a third of it, didn't you?
Yeah.
Out of production. Swears he won't plant it till wheat.
Well, he'd plant it with people.
Yeah.
So he wrote and he says, I understand your mother's been writing to you. hasn't received any response. But of course I know you're too busy with your duties at school and keeping up with your studies and probably working pretty hard. Enclosed, please find $20. You and your brother divide that and go out and have a good time. He signed it and didn't put the 20 in. He got a letter right back.
That was, I knew it. He never puts the dough in. Your mama was mad at that.
Dad, you forgot to put the 20 in.
With your purpose. This may actually be bad luck.
Well, then
luck, really, just luck.
Luck is how you interpret it. Here, the, yeah, supreme and ultimate. Some of the amazingly fortuitous conditions occasionally prevailing on the evolutionary worlds may be due to the gradually emerging presence of the Supreme, the foretasting of his future universe activities. Most of what a mortal would call providential is not. His judgment of such matters is very handicapped by lack of far-sighted vision into the true meanings of the circumstances of life. Much of what a mortal would call good luck might really be bad luck. The smile of fortune that bestows unearned leisure and undeserved wealth may be the greatest of human afflictions. The apparent cruelty of a perverse fate that heaps tribulation upon some suffering mortal may in reality be the tempering fire that is transmuting the soft iron of immature personality into the tempered steel of real character. Oh, that's 1305, middle of the page.
And then I played lock and made on the block.
That's right. That's right. This is correct.
We interpret.
Correct. The papers make a flat statement. Blind and unforeseen accidents do not happen in the cosmos. Here's my interpretation of that. There are three levels of reality in the main. There's the finite level, time, space, experience limited. There's the absolute level, timeless, spaceless. In between, separating them, just like the filling in a sandwich separates the two slices of bread, is the absinthe level. Not finite, not absolute, not independent of time and space, but transcending time and space, in contrast to the absolute level, which ignores time and space, would be unconscious of time and space. The absinthe level is perfectly well aware of the existence of time and space, but it's not limited by them. I think there's all kinds of planning going on all of these levels simultaneously. We're told that the absolutes react in terms of spaceless eternity, which is to say, they react to any given transaction in time and space in terms of all that was, is, or will be. So this reaction is not comprehensible within a given time-space frame. This is a pure, undiluted, eternity reaction. On the transcendental level. Sir?
And predetermined.
I suspect, yes. On the transcendental level, you've got absinthe planning. Planning in terms of an overview of time and space. Planning in terms of remote welfare. Most remote. Ultimate destinies. Not even what we would call remote destinies. Destinies way beyond our use of the term remote. Then I think you've got all kinds of planning within time and space. You've got the planning of a master spirit, of the ancients of days, for the well-being of a super universe in the present universe age.
The rest of this reel, tape 6, this was just started on the left channel. It was real distorted, just like you just heard. So I'm skipped ahead, and it finished out side 1 was just as bad, and most of the segments on side 2, the left channel, were just as bad, and here I am at the last segment of side two, and it has improved. So hopefully it'll fit on this tape.
Faith healing or whatnot. I haven't read enough to know yet, if any.
Laying on the
band? Yeah, we were talking about laying on a band. So.
I can distill their approach. I take a sheet of paper, and I'll draw on several things in the papers. Can you make this figure? Kind of like a headline and then three columns?
Mm-hmm.
All right. As I write, you write with me. Across the top, this is your big headline that goes across all three columns. Write the word reality. Now below that, divide it into thirds. In the first column, like a subheading, write the word thing. In the middle column, write the word meaning. In the last column, write the word value. Now, the papers tell us that reality, and if you capitalize it, it's the biggest word there is. It's as big as infinity. It's everything. Reality divides up into thing, meaning, and value. I'm ignoring personality. This is to say matter, mind, and spirit. You can put that right under there. Under thing, write matter. Under meaning, write mind. Under value, write spirit. They say there are three different kinds of energy, and they obey different laws. I had a long talk with a college professor's wife, who was an intelligent Christian scientist. At dinner, I had inadvertently told a story which poked fun at Christian science. And I could tell by the hush that came over the dinner group that I was laying a nice, great, big, square egg, and there was a good Christian scientist present. And afterwards, this gal, whom I liked very much, said she was sure that I didn't mean any disrespect, and I said, no, I didn't. And I said, let's sit down and talk and compare notes and see why we're so far apart. Here's what it adds up to. Christian science teaches just one form of energy. And we don't have it on this sheet. Don't write it down. But it's about two parts mind and one part spirit. Would be a fair description, an emotion. And since they believe there's only one form of energy, there's only one set of natural laws. And everything works by one formula. The Urantia papers teach that there are three forms of energy. And there are three independent sets of laws that operate. And they recommend that we approach thing problems, and please write this, with reason. That we approach meaning problems with logic. And that we approach value realities with faith. As a result of which, we will produce three very important things. And again, please write. Under reason, science. Under logic, philosophy. And under
also with a PH. Unless you're in Spanish, it's spelled with an S. Under faith, write religion. Let's analyze this. This is all, incidentally, right smack out of the papers, but from different parts. And I've told this story many times when I haven't even discussed the Urantia book, because I found that this little diagram here is tremendously helpful to people in starting out their thinking. If you want to produce a material result, use reason. Follow what you know of science. Set up a material cause, and you will get a material result. If you're dealing with values, I don't think reason is particularly good.
mathematics breaks down on value. What is the mass of love? What is the velocity of love? What is the wavelength of love? What's its amplitude, its frequency, its voltage, its amperage? Ridiculous, isn't it? Listen, if you're a family, you discover two do not live as cheap as one. And then the kids come along. And pretty soon you have budget problems because these dollars are things. And there are only so many of them. But over in the value side, you fall in love with this girl. Or man, as the case may be. I hope you're all sorted out, right? Then a child is born. You have no budget problems in the love department. You love the child. You have another child. You have no difficulty finding brand new love for that second child. You don't have to say, now, I've only got so much love. I've got to cut the pie. First I cut it in two parts. Now I've got to cut it in three. You've got a bigger pie. And within reason, I don't think it would make any difference how many kids you had. You would find fresh, new, newly minted love for each child. Do you see how radically different these columns are? Now, in their pure state, values and things do not touch, ever, in their pure state. But they both touch meanings. And here is where we do our darndest to be logical. And we say, now look, this first cause of science and this loving father of religion, there couldn't be two in the universe. There could only be one. We're looking for universal unity in the domain of philosophy. How do we reconcile? How do we reconcile the Lord of universes with the Father of persons? We feel they're the same. Now, let's complicate it. You see, it's the impurities of life that make things work. Sodium is highly combustible, metallic sodium. But if you can really desiccate sodium, dry it out, so that there isn't any water there at all, it's not so flammable. The thing that makes it work is because it's impure. And this thing here, this is like a compass. It's wonderful to steer by, but you get impurities. I want you to visualize a primitive tribal council. You gals mentally convert yourselves into male warriors in good standing, because of course in a council like this, in a primitive tribe, except in a matriarchy, women just weren't allowed, see? You're all warriors in good standing, and we are here to witness the divine execution of Oglala. Oglala, the poor wretch, has violated a major taboo. That's a sin crime. And unfortunately, under the Internal Revenue Code of this particular tribe, subsection so-and-so, there ain't no forgiveness for this. In fact, if Oglala doesn't die, the whole tribe will come under the interdict. And Oglala knows this too. Now, Oglala's sitting down at the end of the table, see, out in the kind of hinterland. The witch doctor is chanting the long, long death incantation. Many, many verses. Lots of time for pressure to build up. And remember, everyone here believes the witch doctor knows it's going to work. Us warriors know it's going to work. Poor Oglala down there knows it's going to work. And when he gets to the crescendo of the death incantation and reaches over and drops the pinch of purple powder on the fire, which flares up, Oglala is so filled with fear that it triggers his adrenal glands, floods his system with adrenaline, ruptures the heart muscle, and the guy falls over just as dead as a yesterday caught mackerel, and no one touched him. Now, fellow warriors, I want to ask you, do you want any more proof that the spirits killed him? With our own eyes, we saw him die, and no man was near him, and there's no wound in his body. When you deal with living organisms where things, meanings, and values are present, in the same organism, plus personality, plus creative imagination, you can get a hell of a gray area in here. And there is such a thing known as psychosomatic response. There's also somatopsychic response. Now, I'll give you a statistic that shocked me. My papa is a psychiatrist. And before that, he was a surgeon. So he knows the hard-boiled side. And Pop told me one time, he said that 85% of the people would consult a medical doctor if they went in the right time. A Christian Science practitioner could cure them because it's up here. But the other 15%, of course, would break down. Now, this is what clouds the whole issue. Plus, an occasional fluke. I'll give you one you can't explain, but you could have founded a church on this one. Chap came to see my dad, growth on his throat. He says, Doc, examine. So they did a biopsy. Carcinoma simplex. This is a tough form of cancer. Well, he says, I guess I got it. He says, that's the third laboratory that checks me out, and I get the same diagnosis. What should I do? Well, he says, is there anything you particularly want to do? Yeah, I said, I'd like to go fishing. Never had enough fishing. But he got about one good month left. So he went to Canada. Went fishing. He showed up at my dad's house about 5 weeks later, and he had a mason jar with something in it. It was full of whiskey. And this thing had fallen off his neck. And he walked all day and all night to get to where he could get some whiskey to preserve it.
Inside or out?
It was on the neck. The system extruded this cancer. Now, in this case, there's no religious overtone. The guy was fishing. He wasn't praying. He's just fishing in Canada when his cancer fell off of him.
Nature,
there are other cases. They're rare. My dad checked the literature. This has happened. But look what an opportunity. If Pop had only been a witch doctor, with those biopsy reports, you could start a new church on this. Here is a case of the unquestioned faith healing of something which the laboratory reports as carcinoma simplex. And your faith healing would have been pure coincidence. Now, I want to add that to this. Mostly, I think, it's psychosomatic. Once in a blue moon, a human system will do something fluky, like people get a third set of teeth. This can happen. I'm hoping for it any day now. No, you know it happened to my sister. You know that story. This, to me, is a very clean way to think. If you think this way, you can sort your thoughts out, and you can think straight, and you don't get in trouble. When my kids were growing up, they said, how do we pray? What do we pray for? I said, you have two fathers, huh? This gets their attention, like, you know, hitting the mule between the eyes with the baseball bat. I said, yeah. I said, you got a father in heaven, too, you know. Oh, yeah, him. Now, I said, to simplify it, we left the meanings out. I just talked about things and values. We define things in terms of the sensorium. See, touch, taste, feel, hear, and so forth. Now, I said, I'm that kind of a father. You can see me, touch me, and so forth. And I said, your father in heaven, you can't do these things with. And I said, if you want a thing, and again, we went through the senses, like a baseball bat, or an electric train, or a pony. I said, always remember, your father in heaven could get you that. This I believe. But as I observe life, he doesn't do it. And I think I know why. If he did it, I wouldn't have a job. And he wants me to have the experience of being a father. So I said, discuss that with me. There's much more apt to happen. Now I said, if you want something that you can't see, feel, touch, smell, taste, what would that be? I said, like being more happy, like being braver, like being kinder. I don't know how to get you those things. Take that up with your other father. That's in his department. The kids will never be disappointed if they pray that way. Because honestly, I don't think God particularly cares whether they get a baseball bat or not. But I do. I did. But I think he's very concerned with their happiness, with their kindness, with their courage. I am too, but I can't do anything about it. All I can do is feed them and keep them warm, you know, buy them toys, and hope that they're happy. Do you find this helpful? I'll give you mine, Clyde. You didn't make notes.
Not yet.
But don't expect this thing to work rigidly. Because in a living human being, you have all three of these. And you have personality. You have creative imagination. And you can believe in the imaginary. Rationalization is nothing but a prostitution of creative imagination. You know, you mess up your life so that you're always the right guy and everyone else is wearing black hats and you're the only person who's got a white hat on. That's a prostitution of the creative imagination. And Oswaldo died because of an active imagination. Your feelings, your beliefs, your convictions affect your ductless gland system. That in turn determines your blood chemistry at a given moment. And now we're off and running. Now we've gone from the mental to the physical. There's the bridge. It works the other way too. There are somato psychic reactions. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
The papers don't make a flat statement, but this is my distillation of everything that I can find in the papers, which helps me in looking at life, to try to find out what's real. For example, you know, that's a big mystery. People are not two-faced, people are multi-faced. The face a man shows at a cocktail party is not the face he shows his minister Sunday morning when he congratulates Reverend, that was a good sermon. He has a face for his wife and a face for his kids, a face for his business associates. If you're mean, you're apt to beget meanness out of a man. If you're kind, you're apt to be repaid in kindness. What is real? Very interesting. I think Jesus loved human beings so wholeheartedly because he could see finalities in people. Just as parents, especially fathers, mothers too, but mothers love babies as babies. But a typical father loves that baby because of the man to be. An interesting experiment on the difference in sex attitudes. I tried this question on a mixed group, and I said, write your answers down. I said, just for kicks now, the rate of growth of children is going to be changed. You have nothing to do about this. But you do have a choice. They can either grow up half as fast or twice as fast. All the women voted for half as fast, and all the men voted for twice as fast. And it's very illuminating on the difference in the father and mother's attitude. You see, both father and mother love a human being, and mother loves as a female mammal, too, something that no man knows anything about. A woman loves a baby twice, a man loves a baby once. And if you find a man that really loves little babies, I question his sex orientation.
Well, these politicians will kiss all the babies.
Well, that's for bullying. But if he goes, if he really goes over babies, he's apt to swish when he walks, too. You know? Three elements in universal reality: fact, idea, and relation. The religious consciousness identifies these realities as science, philosophy, and truth. Philosophy would be inclined to view these activities as reason, wisdom, and faith. Physical, intellectual, and spiritual reality. We are in the habit of designating these realities as thing, meaning, and value, which I like because it's the simplest. I've many times drawn that chart for many people, and they look at it and they never believe it. They put it in their pocket and take it with them. There's just a lot of truth in that chart. If a saint and a sinner are pushing from my office window, they got a ways to fall to the pavement. Gravity knows not values. These are two physical bodies falling in a planetary gravity field, accelerating at the rate of 16 feet per second per second, right? And the saint and the sinner react differently. The saint, on the way down, the sinner curses God, and the saint prays for succor. I believe with all of my heart that they're going to hit the pavement with identical foot pounds of impact. Because gravity knows not value. Gravity deals only with things. Now, having hit the pavement, skull down, and having died instantly, I think they move in quite different directions from now on out. Now we're in the domain of value. Now we're dealing with the survival of the soul. We're not dealing with a physical body falling in a planetary gravity field. Isn't this helpful at all? You have a sick baby. Get a pediatrician fast. Having got the best medical help you can on the job, then if you want to pray, you still don't have to practice magic. You still don't have to say, God, please let my child live, which means suspend natural law. That's the effort to practice magic. I will not criticize a person who prays that way sincerely, but we should know better. The prayer you can really pray is, thank God, nothing can really happen to this child, even though she died. This is not a permanent injury, just a temporal injury. I can be hurt, but the child can't be hurt. Then you can pray a legitimate prayer of thanksgiving to your Father in heaven for having established a universe in which children cannot be hurt. You see, hurt is two different things from his viewpoint and your viewpoint. Some of John the Baptist's followers couldn't understand why Jesus wasn't excited about getting John out of the jug. But John was looking beyond this life, and they were looking only within this life. Hello, Mary Catherine. We'll change the subject now. We'll go back to the Urantia book and stop talking about Mary Catherine. But this can be treacherous. The cancer that falls off the man's neck. You can have hysteroid paralysis. And try and convince that person they can't walk. But there are two ways you can cure them. One is put them through a sugar pill, fake therapy, which is all fake. And at a certain point, when they see this light go on and they feel the electrical shock, they'll walk. You're building up faith in science. Or if you're 6.5 feet tall and have a long white beard and wear a white robe and look like Khalil Gibran and the prophet, you can say, my child, throw away your crutches and they'll platter and they'll walk. It won't be like the guy who says, you know, when he threw his crutches away, what happened? He said, I'd fall on my face, he says. That's a good question. Any other questions?
Does Mary Catherine
speak?
Does Mary Catherine switch when she walks?
Sure she does. She's a real female. Women should switch when they walk.
She do.
How would you like me to read you an essay? Are you folks far enough along so you would enjoy the story of a local universe and how it gets started? And if I go too fast, stop me and say define it. Is that fair enough? You see, one of the things I'm working on is a series of, I call them appendices because they support a narrative. But it's a series of essays, the papers that weren't written, where it's all through the book. There is no single place you can go. And I'm curious. And it would be handy to get to, in just one place, get all the information that's pertinent about a given subject where there is no paper. So this is Appendix 9, entitled The Chronology of Local Universes. In previous appendices, we studied the mechanisms of experiential growth and the techniques that are involved in this process. One of the objectives of this appendix is to observe something of this growth process, especially the creative and the evolutionary techniques as it operates in the local universe. It is also the purpose of this appendix to bring together what the papers have to say about the chronology of a local creation. What is the exact sequence of events from the physical emergence of a nebula through the ensuing developments to the era of light and life? This story will be based on the story of our universe, Nebadon, because we've been told more about it than any other. You still want to hear it? Okay. Huh? You want your game? Good. Were you up all night? Ultimate physical beginning. We doubt that the record of the ultimate physical beginnings of Nebadon is even in the archives of Ubersa. That's the capital of our superuniverse. I'm not going to read you all my references because I got this thing is studded with references in the papers. If it is, then it was not available long ago to the Ubersa Council of Equilibrium, because this council of associate force organizers had to be informed that certain space conditions in the superuniverse had become favorable for the materialization of a nebula. We suspect that the record of the ultimate beginnings of the Andromeda Nebula, a component of our local universe, is to be found only in the westerly regions of paradise, in the archives of the architects of the master universe. These architects are the supervisors of the primary force organizers and are the projectors and planners of the material creation. As the papers present the story, the Andromeda Nebula was initiated in three steps, the latter two of which involved the primary force organizers, those beings who performed the original work of beginning the materialization of the physical creations of space. These three steps were as follows. A. At some distant point in time, and it seems likely that this was very considerably more than 1,000 billion years ago, some modification took place in a certain portion of the space potency of the unqualified absolute, which caused it to become potentially responsive to the passive presence of the primary force organizers. Perhaps this modification was brought about by the space force mechanism that is situated on Nether Paradise. It will be recalled that space potency pervades all universe space, and that it is the original pre-reality potential out of which all physical reality ultimately emerges. See, what we're taking inventory of here in crude terms is this. We look up in the sky. This is a crude analogy. The blue sky, nothing is there. Actually, there's a lot of water vapor up there, but it's invisible. Then the atmosphere becomes chilled, and suddenly a cloud forms. Something has happened. There's something up there now. It registers things. It was there all the time, but it was invisible to us. and then it rains. And as it rains, it gets very cold. So what comes down is hail. And we can pick up the hailstones. And to a primitive man, seemingly from nothing, now comes this cold, hard object out of the sky. We who are more sophisticated know that the ice is merely a different form of the water vapor, which was invisible. So what we're describing here is a process, starting out with seeming nothingness, like the invisible water vapor, and pretty soon we're going to have a something.
Rest of that one's like that too. That was side two of reel six, left channel. So we'll now go to side one, reel six, right channel.